How good are numbers? They can blow minds, they can help us see the invisible, and they can even help us count. But in the wrong hands, they can also numb. On Thursday, April 20, Sweathead is hosting our first ever online conference about numbers, number-adjacent things, and number-identifying people. It's called WTF, the Effing Effectiveness Festival. Over 3 hours, 9 number experts will try to blow your mind one at a time. Do you have a mind? Well, prepare to get it blown by Associate Marketing Professor Colin Campbell in his plea to get you to do A-B testing. Google's Esty Gorman and her demand that we F the funnel. Sage's James Hankins in his sharing about the importance of share of search. Ogilvy's Ella Jenkins poking at our subconscious and how it's our boss. Magic Numbers' Dr. Grace Kite's warning about the dangers of digital attribution. DCDX's Andrew Roth's gravity-defying tale about the black hole consuming Gen Z. Walk Headbrain David Tiltman's work about how often creative award winnings are also effing effective. Author and System One's Orlando Wood's sour take about how the advertising brain has turned to lemons. And Jellyfish's Tom Roach will drop some squishy effectiveness pearls of wisdom all over the place. WTF, the effing effectiveness festival. It's marketing that will blow your mind from Sweathead, the strategy people inside your head. Online, Thursday, April 20, 2023, from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. ET. That's New York time, baby. Find out more at sweathead.com. Group discounts are available. What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I'm recording this into my phone, but I'll make it sound nice. I'm sitting in a car park, soccer dad style, out in Fresh Meadows, New York City, St. John's University. Last few months that I get to do this is my boy's next soccer situation appears or will appear. Well, this one ends. It's been interesting. I'll talk about being a soccer dad. He's had an interesting interesting 6 years, thousands of hours of driving to training and to all kinds of things, lots of great opportunities. I just got back from Mexico. I brought back a tourist too. I got a bug. I was in Mexico City for a few days doing some training down there. Shout outs to Agencia I who brought us out there. We trained on Friday and Saturday in a comedy club. If we do training together, I'm going to say, can we go to a comedy club? Because then I get to make points, not earn points, but make points about things that I believe. Also, shout outs to Michael Goldstein from DDB who came. Had some really cool situations, actually. Had really good chats with a few couples that I know, including Carl Isaac, who I've interviewed on this program. Program what? Getting all serious now, Mark. On this podcast, he's former CMO of Adobe and eBay. And also, I met his partner. I'm sure it's okay to say all of this, right? Val, who's the chief creative officer of a big agency called Critical Mass. And we had this really interesting chat, which got serious quickly, which are the only chats that I can really handle. And we're in Condesa in Mexico City. It was a fancy area. Everything was a little bit broken where I was through Mexico City. It was kind of charming, but, you know, tiles would be chipped, footpaths would be up and down, broken, all that kind of stuff. But I could tell this neighborhood, it's got a lot of cash on the inside. And that's not just because I might have been at a restaurant on Thursday night full of mafia. When you're in a restaurant, there's like at least 50 dudes who are really big and you're going to the gym and you're like, no, they're really big and the waiters are really big too. And, you know, the vibe, everyone was dressed really well. A few really flamboyant suits, which I was told is the narco uniform. Kept my eyes to myself a little bit. And then, you know, after a 4-hour dinner at 11 p.m., everyone's dancing, not us, not me. Everyone was dancing in a circle. Some music came on and louder music came on. Different louder music came on, and then everyone's smashing plates into a box. It was intense. That was my Thursday night in Mexico City. I will always remember that. And I think I'll always remember this next moment. Friday night, after a full day of training, I'm usually feeling a bit fetal after training, a bit vulnerable. Do people like that? Was that good for them? I hope it was good for them. I think they were learning. Who am I in the world? It's a combination of all those feelings. Excited, really fulfilled on it. I get to do this stuff. A little bit sad. All the emotions at once, whatever that's called. For me, it's called fetal. And was having a conversation with Carl and Val, who happened to be in Mexico City from the USA. They were attending a wedding. I could have gone to this Jewish wedding on Saturday night, apparently, as a stranger. Starts at 10 p.m. Apparently, they go to 6 a.m., dinner served at midnight. I could have, but I was already in bed at 6:30 p.m. on Saturday night with a little bug, a little buggity bug that I've had for a few days now. Not too bad, thanks for asking. Not too bad, but it's there and it made me feel like a bit of a zombie. And so had this other moment, other than the four-hour moment, that's what it felt like, a four-hour moment surrounded by mafia, in this bar in Condesa. I refuse to say that word properly, don't I? It's not Condesa, it's Condesa. We were talking about some sad stuff, some meaningful stuff, some important stuff, which I won't go into. Carl and Val, you're safe. And I remember going to the restroom and bringing that vibe with me, the sort of sad, melancholic vibe. It was momentary, right? It was momentary. I wasn't feeling sad for myself. Oh, I probably was, actually, just momentarily. It happens. It'll happen after a few beers. It was not a lot of beers. It was early in the night. It was a few beers. But we just had this chat where we realized that some of our experiences were very overlapped. And the symptoms that some people we know have are very overlapped. And that, for me, is extremely rare. And I remember I went to this restroom. I'm pretty sure it was a green wall. It was all a little bit broken. Bit of a smell. Nervous about the water. Nervous about all the things. Because I was already feeling a little bit sick. And I was standing there facing the wall. You asked. I was not sitting down. I was standing. And I dragged this sort of slightly melancholic vibe in there with me despite a great day. Really enjoying the company of the people, what we were doing. I dragged this melancholic vibe in there. And then I remember just looking at the wall and smiling. I felt full of possibility, and it's something that I've been doing therapy for a few months now. I've been talking to the therapist about it, you know, trying to process some stuff and understand certain situations and conflict better and how to deal with it all better. The therapist doesn't usually tell you what to do, but you work it out, you explore things. And I've said to him, you know, I created this little compartment in my life that you're a part of, by the way. Sorry, you're a part of it. I dragged you into that. Not only did I drag melancholic feelings into a green-walled bathroom in Mexico City in Condesa, I've dragged you into the compartment of my life through which I'm trying to self-actualize. I am trying to be more of myself, more of who I can be, more of who I could be, more of who I might be before I pass away. I'm not passing away that I know, I don't know that I am, but I do use that as a way to think. And so, yeah, I was talking to a therapist about feeling full of possibility despite some of this stuff, and it's great because that feeling is way better than being stuck in the past or ruminating about other things. And so I'm staring at this wall in this bar and feeling full of possibility, and also just aware of some of the sadness that I carry around with me quite often. And it was a great feeling. It was just a great feeling. I went out and I said to Carl and Val, I was like, you know, I know we're having a serious chat and we're talking about some difficult things that people have been through. The people at the table, there were three of us, that we'd been through. But I feel full of possibility too. And both of these things can be true, that sometimes we have some churn, some turmoil, long-term turmoil in us. Doesn't matter about other people, their role in it, but for some reason this stuff's in us. And yet also, especially if you do creative work, full of possibility, and I love that feeling. It's taken the past few years to reach it, to be honest, and 7 years in New York having set this stuff up that I'm doing now to really get there. So I just wanted to share that with you. I'll share some other epiphanies about therapy soon too, if you're interested. A few pieces of news and then I'm going to get into Miyamoto Musashi. So, Sweathead, we've got a ton of good stuff coming up. We're launching a new newsletter on Fridays. It's going to be called FFS for Friday's sake. We're going to take the best / most popular marketing advertising links of the week and make you laugh. That's the goal, okay? Links in the show notes if you want to sign up to that and or to the other newsletter from which I'm going to read today called Strategy for Life. I think that's what we're going to call it from now on. So we've got For Friday's Sake and Strategy for Life. Fun. Subscribe to them, share them around. You can also, if you subscribe, you can get access to this career planning toolkit that the team put together. My team put together after the Sweathead Get Ahead. We've already had something like 700 downloads in the past week. A really good little resource there. I've not had a lot of feedback about it, but we've seen a lot of downloads. So that means that people are sending it around because that's how this stuff works, kids. We have a wonderful event coming up. WTF, the Effing Effectiveness Festival. Check it out online. That's April 20, the day after. We have lots of speakers for that. The day after I'm doing, on the day that I get older, a thing about finding a strategy voice. That's April 21. Aisha Hakim, ACD, right, at 72 and Sunny, is doing a masterclass in May about the art of deck making. So we've got a lot of great stuff coming up. We'll soon have details about the summer camp. The subtitle for the Sweathead Summer Camp is this, the C word awakening. Oh, you're so rude, Mark. Take it back. No, I won't take it back. Take it back. No. We're going to do 4 weeks on the four C's. I think we've got eight to 10, actually. Really great speakers, some of whom are repeats. I like to repeat some people that I like it. We're going to do an especially larger day or a larger session around culture, because all of you kids, you love your culture because you get to learn about you. That's what that's about. I know it. I see statistics. I see that when we publish something about Gen Z, it's because you get to understand and listen to stuff about you. That's what that is. Also coming up, masterclasses in Bulgaria. I'm talking at a conference called DigiTalk in Sofia. We're going to have some fun stuff about that, possibly even on the podcast. And if you're kind of in that area or on the way to it, I'm thinking about whether I can do some company training or public training on the way or there or on the way back. So somewhere in Europe or relatively close to that. So if you're interested, let me know. Ecuador is happening in June. I'll be sharing more details about that. We're doing three cities in Ecuador. I think it's going to be pretty good and pretty big. I'm hearing it's going to be pretty big, so I'll share details about that with you soon. And then I think about an hour ago, I've agreed to doing something in Batumi, Georgia, in Europe. It's above Turkey. That's Europe, right? Eastern Europe. And that is in September for an event called Ad Black Sea. I'm excited about that. It's going to take a bit of time to get there. And so again, if you're in the area or on the way, now on the way or on the way back could involve anywhere in Europe or the Middle East. I'm thinking about, I'd love to do an event in Istanbul, possibly Germany, maybe England. But then if we go back to Batumi and down, we have places, well, down from Istanbul, we have places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So if you know anyone in an industry body or an event promoter who can help put some stuff on, let me know, all right? That's all the stuff that's happening. There's a ton of stuff. But definitely sign up to that new newsletter. Okay, now I want to read you something, a little bit of a different format today. This is called When Work Doesn't Want You to Work. By me. I put my back into this today. It's in the newsletter, Strategy for Life. It's in the newsletter. I put my back into it. I was like, I need to write something. If I can't get this bug out of me, maybe I got to get this idea out of me. Am I right? Okay. When work doesn't want you to work. Keep in mind that I've not eaten or drunk much in 4 days. My lips are all dry, and I will probably try to speak English, but in a Spanish format, even though I can't speak Spanish because I'm also confused, just generally speaking. Okay. Miyamoto Musashi is Japan's samurai of samurais. He was so into swords, he used two of them at a time. This led him to 61 duels. He was two fighters with two swords and one human, but he started out as an animal. Later, he wrote a book called The Book of Five Rings. In his clear-headedness, he didn't name the book Five Rings. He named it The Book of Five Rings, just in case anybody had any doubts about it being a book. However, this kind of clear-headedness was hard-earned. Musashi ended up a national hero, but he would have been cancelled before he began in our times. And rightly so. In the Akira Kurosawa movie version of Musashi's life, Musashi is a troubled and enraged child that nobody wants. So he mucks about his village, causing mayhem. This other book, Iron John, a book about men, calls this aimless phase the Ashes. Big shout outs to strategist and researcher from nonfiction Lindsay Waking for giving me that book a few years ago. It was really interesting. The Ashes. The Ashes is a phase in our lives when we're between being carefree children and adults with clear responsibilities. Some of you listening to this right now are in your own Ashes phase right now, and many of us, including me, are probably a little bit envious of you, although I like being responsible. I like making things. I like putting them into the world that involves responsibility. This phase, this ashes phase, is proxied, generally speaking, in the West by the idea of a gap year. In the US, a gap year is seen as a way to, quote unquote, rebrand yourself so you can stand out amongst other college applicants. I found that on a website, usnews.com. I don't know if they just focus on college stuff, but I literally found that there. And I was like, wow, that is so American. In other countries, a gap year is an excuse to, quote unquote, work at a bar, but mostly to get drunk. Musashi emerges from his aimless phase with a goal. And I will say, the Wikipedia version of his history is different from the movie version. And what's confusing about the movie version is that the main actor was 34 at the time of making the first movie, whereas Musashi was already kind of on his way to being a well-known fighter as a teenager. So I don't really know how this all works out. Okay, but my story, Pillages, the Kurosawa version. So Musashi emerges from his aimless phase with a goal. He decides to become a samurai. Wouldn't it be funny if the reality of this decision is like he was 7? But we're all like, oh, he's probably 26. So after he reaches or decides on this goal, his first step is to join an army and do some killing. This doesn't work because his army is defeated. He gets caught up in some stuff. And he tries to return home, but people are searching for him. So he does some more killing until a Buddhist monk tricks him into his next phase of life, self-mastery. In these times, Musashi has already been cancelled, but the Buddhist monk sees something in him and asks him, are you an animal or a human? Then he locks him in a room with books for a year. It's kind of funny, really, if you think about modern times. I mean, this guy's literally just running around being a deviant and people don't like him, his family doesn't like him, and look, he probably needed to go to therapy to deal with that. Who knows if it was his fault initially or if it's their fault, they treated him mean and then he became unlovable, because it's sometimes easier to be unlovable so that you can avoid being loved and then unloved. You avoid rejection, is what I'm saying, with a very long run-on sentence. That was probably 4 paragraphs. It was one sentence in my head. But look, let's face it, this guy's in jail. These times, he's in jail. If he's in the wrong state in the US, he's not around much longer. Not around much longer. But this monk's like, hey, dude, seems okay. Seems okay. And he asks him, are you an animal or a human? Then he locks him in a room with books for a year. When I think about being locked in a room with books for a year, I think about Rachel Mercer. Many of you know her. She's lovely. She's a friend. She ran strategy at RGA in New York, recently had a child. Hope you and the family are doing well there, Rachel. And she often publishes a list of all the books she's read in a year. And I reckon she read way more books in any year than Musashi read in his 1 year. You know, just Rachel's average, definitely higher than Musashi's 1 year. Totally, totally. Now, in the movie, there's a lot of books there. It's a lot of books. Maybe, you know, a book every 2 days. I reckon Rachel would crush that. Crush it. I don't know if she's read Musashi the novel, though. I have. It's quite long. It's tasty. It's tasty. So, the monk locks Musashi in this room, and he gives him a challenge. Do you want to keep thrashing about life wildly following your instincts, or do you want to cultivate yourself and channel your instincts for good? A year later, Musashi emerges more noble. A year of forced education and self-regulation cultivate him so that as he goes about killing more people... what? He has the skills to write a better book about it later. All right? Sure, he was a killer, but he read books. It's okay. It's okay. I don't mean to be like flippant about things that are actually happening in the real world. I'm being flippant about something here, okay? They're separate things, so don't let me trigger you. That's what I'm saying, separate things. But what's interesting about the story in the movie, and Kurosawa's dealings with Musashi, and I think a lot of his other films, they deal with really big topics, but in really stubborn ways. Like, they don't try to do too much. You know, this movie has a lot about animal versus human, and also about love. About love. And the price that Musashi pays for becoming a sick fighter is a life without love, it seems. Correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, I'm only up to number 2 in the trilogy. Again, I've forgotten the 3rd one, even though I've read the book. maybe he gets married and has a big family. I just don't think that's what a samurai did back then. I don't think it's what a samurai would do now if he was truly, or she or they were truly a samurai. So the price he pays for this cultivation, and cultivation is a useful thing to think about if you're trying to grow up, the price he pays is a life without love. Like Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride, sword thrusts were Musashi's main love language. Human love would have been a distraction. Totally get that. I mean, if I had that, do you think I'd write a book or do podcasts? That is such a joke. I'm joking. No, we all need to kind of give and receive love differently, don't we? Speaking of which, enter Gary Chapman. If only Gary Chapman had lived centuries earlier, then his book, The Five Love Languages, might have understood that the Book of Five Rings. Oh, I see what you did there, Gary. Gaza, you do a bit of Musashi. He likes the five. His book, The Five Love Languages, might have understood that the Book of Five Rings was explaining a sixth love. I'm just giving you stuff to count now. Now, am I telling you this just so I can tell you that I'm rewatching Kurosawa's trilogy and that I've read the original novel and that the actor who played Musashi, named Toshiro Mifune, was asked to play Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars, and that many American movies and TV shows borrow from Musashi, especially movies involving a lot of aimless, then purposeful, Don Quixote-esque wandering around? A little. I also know my people, our readers and listeners. They like to marinate in rabbit holes. That means you gotta like go into a rabbit hole, get some sauce poured on you, just stay down there a little bit. Get close to a flame, maybe. No, that's not marination, that's cooking. What am I talking about? Mixing the metaphor, Mark, you crazy man. He goes to Mexico, has dinner in a restaurant full of mafia, comes back all like mixed metaphor. Duh, what? All right, but I know my people are readers and listeners. They like to, you like to listen to marinate in rabbit holes, and you know, short cuts aren't as good as long cuts. I believe that to be true. So here's the point. In many companies right now, strategy is in an ashes phase, and that's spelled A-S-H-E-S. If you're in England or Australia, yeah, there's a famous cricket battle competition called the Ashes. We're talking about something else. In many companies right now, strategy is in an ashes phase. It's caught between its carefree childhood and an adulthood with clear responsibilities, and that being caught between sounds like this. Mark, where I work, well, it's hard. We have a good team. We have good clients, but people don't really... It's always that. They don't really know how to bring us onto projects. Really? People don't want to pay for our time. People ignore our creative briefs. We have to write really long, useless business documents that people borrow from but mostly ignore. Management tells us we matter, but it's so hard. Too hard. It's really hard to make an impact. What am I doing wrong? Really? So apologetic. That's an apologetic, really. I'm sorry for saying this. This is the sound of a strategy team that's thrashing about like an animal trying to get traction on a treadmill. Why is strategy stuck between childhood and adulthood in some places? There are three reasons. List equal time. One, clients don't want strategy. The book The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen describes this paradox. Businesses might want to evolve, but their current customers buy them for what they are, or maybe really what they were. So existing clients often put a drag on a company. If you've had a few years of making really funny ads, people are probably going to come to you for a funny ad. If you had a history of making viral ads, people will come to you because I want a video that goes viral. If you had a history of making explainer videos, people are like, yeah, make that explainer video. If you had a history of making really formal, serious work that CEOs with no fun in them would buy, you're going to keep doing that. I believe that. It's hard to change. The second reason that companies, departments, etc., can be stuck between childhood and adulthood in the ashes is your company doesn't want strategy. Have you ever worked in a place that hired strategists but didn't want them? I have. How do I know? Because I used to run people through my training and I'd give them my problem at the time. None of you seem to want strategists here. Why? Real answers I've heard from very senior people, senior as in 45-year-old plus, not senior like you're 26 and you became a senior strategist. That's not senior, by the way. You're too young. Real answers. I want to be the smartest person in the room. I don't want to share my clients with anyone. I am the strategist. Third reason for that stuckness. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you're doing. You, us, we, you don't know what you're doing. Yeah, there are strategists who let down the occupation. I think they're few and far between. I hope they are. But there are also people who are new to the occupation, and often they might be the only strategist in the village. Little Britain reference. And don't have any leadership. I hear a lot of stories. People 22, 23, 24, they get the strategy bug. They realize how cool we are. I'm just saying, it's a cool thing. Oh, strategy's cool. I'm joking. It's not about that. It's because they see themselves and a potential future for themselves in that role where they get to think and be creative and, you know, write and express and learn. But sometimes people are too young without any leadership, and sometimes there are just strategists who survive systems and bureaucracy and large companies who really should not be doing that role, right? But we've got to point the fingers at ourselves too, all right? So I hope this is all makes sense. The three reasons why strategy can be stuck between childhood and adulthood are: one, clients don't want strategy; two, your company doesn't want strategy; three, you don't know what you're doing, all right? So what do you do about all of this? What do you do about the ashes phase? What do you do about that stuckness? One is you stare reality in the face. So in our line of work, here's a truth that is difficult to stomach. We get to do more of what we've done. I just said that differently. We get to do more of what we've done. Yeah, I'm sitting here with a stomach bug from Mexico City. You're so exotic, Mark. Oh, God, you get around the world, you jet setter, you. But I can deal with this bug more easily than that truth. Change is hard, and I'm a sucker. I've bought into all these stories. Oh, we're going to change the agency. We're going to get strategy working here. We're going to do. I'm like, yeah, cool. Sign me up. I can help do that. I know what I'm doing. Oh, it's hard, man. Human. Change is hard. Not only do you need to change, but to sell what you change into, you need other people to want then pay for what you change into. This is why it's important to ponder your answer to this question. What's the one thing you, or we, want to be known for? And if you're a strategist, your answer could be broad like strategy. It could be small like creative briefs. It could be running workshops. It could be critical thinking. You could think in creative ways about it all. For me, it's probably something like teaching people strategy by teaching them about themselves, or maybe more accurately, teaching people strategy by helping them study themselves. You decide what your answer to that question is. But once you or your company locks it in, any meaningful shift is difficult. It really is. Staring reality in the face means working out how you and your company or department are currently perceived and used. Idealism matters. It's our electricity, but start with that reality. Step two, define the problem. Oh, hi, it's Mark here. Define the problem. Any conversation with me, you bring up an issue and it sounds like you want some thoughts on it, I'll be like, well, what's the problem here? I'm not a robot. You're a robot. Define the problem. So the three problems that I just went through, they're perfectly fine starting points, and you could dig into them, but they're perfectly fine starting points. So if clients don't want to pay for strategy, sell in strategy as a default activity to new clients. This might require you to attract a new kind of client, a point made by The Innovator's Dilemma, that book. I remember meeting the management team at McCann, New York about 8 years ago. I had worked at McCann in Australia 16 years ago. And I remember that they just assembled this new group at the top, and they put most of their energy, I believe, into trying to get new clients who would embrace a new kind of work. And this was after McCann, the network, would you call McCann a network or the global agency, was lit up by that Australian campaign, Dumb Ways to Die. They started to win more awards. They were winning awards in different parts of the world, but they had a few things that really kicked off for them, and they tried to double down on that energy to the point where they brought the Australian creative involved with that. Did they put him in like a global role? I've forgotten. Right, but the point is that they try to do their best work for their current clients, but they also put a lot of excessive energy or extra energy into landing new clients with a new way of working, a new philosophy. That's what the Innovator's Dilemma would suggest that you try to do. Now, the other one is if your company doesn't want strategy, you're in a more difficult place. Oh, this is so exhausting. Because you got to work out how to even discuss this and whether you discuss it. I got to tell you, I will share some of these stories every now and then. I try to be a bit neutral about the people who've done these things, but I know there's a joy of revenge in some of these little stories, and I'm sorry about that, but there just is. But I was gaslit by the president of one place I worked at when I brought these issues up. right? And that was after running a workshop with 40 of their most senior people in Washington, D.C. about the topic of people not wanting to bring in or pay for strategists. And having spoken with at least another 50 people at the agency, as well as former employees who try to solve this issue of strategy or account planning at this agency. Like, I literally had data. Didn't have a survey, didn't have a percentage, but I had data. And I was just gaslit. And the other thing that I still kick myself about this to this day, although, look, if I didn't have that weird experience for me, maybe I wouldn't have written a book, or I would have written a different kind of book. But it led to a crisis. It led to like a spiritual crisis, and I processed that through a book. But I had this other interaction. I had a series of interactions, but I had one. When I was interviewing or being approached about senior roles, when I was interviewing for or being approached about senior roles, I would usually ask the most senior person, you know, a president or CEO, like, look, personally, you know, like, I've been through some stuff, and personally I'm attracted to leaders who've also been through some stuff. I feel like people who've been through things, have dealt with difficulty, maybe even at a young age, can make really interesting leaders. That's what I believe. And then I said to this person, do you relate to any of that, or did you go through some stuff, and did that form any point of view or any part of your point of view about being a leader? And the person kind of looked at me like I was weird and just said no. And that was the end of the conversation. That was the end of the breakfast. Now, the fact that this person was the opposite gender to me, gender's on the spectrum, sure. But this person was the opposite gender to me. I overcorrected. I assumed there was going to be some empathy there. And I was like, oh no, what have I done? After I took the job and started, I was like, low empathy situation here. And then if I brought up the fact that I was having all these interactions with people and they didn't really want it to work, somehow this got twisted and it was my fault. It wasn't said like that, but I'd get patronized, like, oh, if you ever need any help. And I was like, no, I'm literally saying that I need help. Well, if you ever need any help, you know, like, that was a bad thing. There was a certain tone. I didn't do the tone justice. So we all go through this. And if you've ever worked with me or ever work with me, I hope I'm not that person for you. I really do. I really hope that I'm not, or haven't been. And if I have been or will be, I'm sorry, or am. So if your own company doesn't want strategy, you kind of have these options. You bring up the issue with some possible solutions, but you then deal with the potential for reprisal. It can be dangerous, depending on your relationships. Okay, you could keep your head down and do what you're told. It's probably 80% of the workforce out there. You could take your department on a tour of the company to sell strategy into colleagues, do a listening tour, tell us all about you, and then we'll do some teaching. I don't know. I hope so. I hope that works. Or you could go where you wanted. And I'll give you another crappy truth. Mostly, it's not your fault if strategy doesn't work at your company. Here's a headline. When strategy doesn't work at a company, it's a failure of a leadership. And if the management team goes through strategy leaders like rolls of toilet paper, maybe they're crapping in the wrong place. This churn happens because the management team doesn't understand the discipline, won't share power, won't make strategy activities default in the processes and client relationships, won't make strategy a front office thing, your back office, get back there, give me your decks. And it happens when management teams make decisions based on a casting mindset or optics, you know, who looks good or who seems to play that role well. Happens a lot in the US. And finally, the third problem I mentioned, which is you don't know what you're doing. Well, that's one of the easier things to fix, because you can have a sense of control over that more. You know, read, study, learn. Bring in some people who know what they're doing. Now, the third thing you can do if your situation is stuck in the ashes is go where you wanted. Some of you are in a superhero phase right now, even while your strategy discipline is in an ashes phase at your company. You might not even know this. You think you're going to fix it all. You bought a story and you're like, yep, I'm going to bring strategy here. It's going to work. And I hope it does. But in your mind, you're a superhero right now. You don't want to hear this. You're just going to keep on flying in your fancy superhero clothes because you're unique and exceptional. And you're going to fly straight into the sun and boom, you're a hero. I hope this happens for you though. I do.
but that's a rare situation. Single percentage points, just to do more math to show you that I'm number literate. It's hard. You know, there's a lot of research in Harvard Business Review that talks about how change initiatives tend to fail. So companies can change without it being from a change initiative, but change is hard. And I think one of the little paradoxes in our industry is that a lot of us who do creative work are change-oriented, call it progressive as being change-oriented. And we think we're doing creative work, but we often are selling into people who are not change-oriented or we're in an established business model. Come on, how much has the business model really changed when it comes to agency work? Not a lot. Not a lot. People talk a game every few years about skin in the game and getting equity. Well, most of those companies don't survive. So are you getting anything? You're getting air. So look, if you're in this superhero phase right now, I hope it works out for you. I've tried to be in that phase. I've tried to sort of bring things to places. And, you know, sometimes I talk about this stuff and people might think I'm being negative. I'm not. I'm literally reporting on hundreds of conversations and surveys that we do. And to add to that, my hunch is that based on my conversations with people and the sweathead surveys we've done over the years, I feel like at least half of strategists and people who do some kind of strategy work in an agency or in an in-house team, they kind of know they're in this ashes, weird situation. But I think there's another smaller group, maybe 20%, that don't even know they are. So what I'm saying is I feel like the majority of us right now, in this time, well, that was very dramatic, Mark. Say the same thing, but with different words. I think a lot of us, most of us, the majority of us doing this kind of work are in situations that are the ashes, where you're in there, but the people around you, the company doesn't really want you to be a full-blown adult. What does a full-blown adult situation look like? Well, a strategist would probably be in the C-suite in a meaningful way. I've been in a leadership team and I thought I was in the C-suite. Nope. That was weird. Discovered that after I joined. Same person, by the way, as the one I mentioned earlier. Oh my God. It's crazy, crazy. You'd be in the C-suite in a meaningful way, which means you're sitting with the CEO and CFO very often to talk about the business. You might even have a strategist on the board. That doesn't happen. Very rare, very rare. It starts with that. That's probably the main green flag. So eventually, if you stick around this industry long enough, you'll learn that you need to go where you're wanted. Sure, you can milk a salary and health insurance for a few years, but then what? And I'm not telling you to give up. But when it comes to being wanted, you kind of have like three options here. So many lists, Mark, so many lists. Three options. You can make people want you. You can try to make people want you. You can survive as long as you can without being wanted. Put your head down. Or you can go where you wanted. Now, maybe in your company that's working on this one brand with this one client or on this one project with this one internal team and it's great and you wanted there. Be there. Be your best self there too. Come on, kids. Be your best selves. Do it. Alana Bryant said this incredible thing, well-known chief strategy officer, lovely person, and also one of the first, if not the first, American planner in London in the 1990s. And she said back then, unless the planner's name was on the door, unless the head of planning's name was on the door, I wouldn't have worked there, something like that. It's really interesting, isn't it? Think about it. So Musashi followed his sword. He cultivated himself, then he wandered around Japan trying to test himself against the best with the goal of being known as Japan's samurai of samurais. But if you're an agency or in-house team leader, so I'm going to speak directly to the leaders right now. I'm going to shake you around a little bit. I'll give you a hug afterwards. We can have a beer. We can go watch some stand-up comedy together. If you're a comic and you're a business leader, I'll come watch you do stand-up comedy. But if you're an agency or in-house team leader, I want to speak to you now. Think about the monk and his role in Musashi's life. The monk encouraged Musashi's self-cultivation and he told him there's a place in the world for him if he can emerge cultivated. And then he kind of kept him safe a little bit in that world. Leaders, if your strategy discipline is in the ashes, be like the monk. stop the divisive corporate politics I've seen up close in the USA, in which leaders use American individualism to divide and conquer their own workplaces. Unite your workplace in a room, possibly full of books, and don't let your workplace leave until they're ready to meet the world like Musashi did, with sword and mind sharpened. Management teams. If your strategy team isn't working, it's your fault. It just starts and stops there. The older I get, it just starts and stops there. Now, if you're a strategist in a management team trying to make things work, yeah, it's partly your fault, but it's the whole team's fault. The staff doesn't work unless there has to be a whole body, a whole team, a whole company desire for it. It has to be built into systems. Strategists can't be chasing work all over the place and working on pitches but not getting put on the pitch that they won, and then having to fight for money and even running around the building figuratively or literally these days to work out if the pitch was won, and then finding out it was a month ago but nobody told them. Like, come on, man. Management teams, if your strategy team isn't working, it's your fault. I can't make this any clearer, but I'm not saying it to make you feel bad. I'm saying it so you take action. Fetch all the difficult truths from your strategy team, their colleagues, and your clients. Realize you don't have all the answers. Ask for answers and listen. Oh, such a big epiphany there, Mark. Oh, do it, though. Yeah? Do it. Talent is everywhere. There's more talent in this industry than leadership. But the thing is, a lot of companies are bringing in strategists for the first time. And I will use the first time. I will define what I mean by the first time. Any company that has not had strategists until the past 10 years, you're bringing in strategists for the first time. And bringing in strategists for the first time is not like getting a new hairstyle. Am I saying that just so I can tell you I'll get a haircut recently? My most aggressive haircut since the pandemic? Maybe, although watching Musashi and his long hair, I'm like, maybe I should have kept it a little long and feral. Bringing in strategists for the first time is not like getting a new hairstyle. Bringing in strategists for the first time is like adopting a child in the ashes. And getting the discipline, the strategy discipline to work, it's full-blown adult responsibility. Leaders only take it on if you're up for the challenge. You don't just hire a leader or that 22-year-old strategist, you know, that one person who's going to be your strategy department. You don't just get to hire them and then complain that it's not working, while you're probably acting every day against their interests. Let's say you're a CEO, but you're from a creative background and you want to kind of control the company and all the creative output. And now all of a sudden you've got a bunch of strategists there and you're getting these annoying things called creative briefs. Maybe you're always getting creative briefs, but these creative briefs are annoying because they've got a little bit of an idea in them. Not a campaign idea, but a lateral thought and an insight. And you're like, no, that's interfering with me. I'm running this company and I'm head of creative output. I hear about that. That happens. There are tons of companies that are like that. Or what about the place that didn't really have strategists, but the model's been around for decades and they start to bring in strategists, and then all of a sudden the strategist is like, can I meet the client? Can I come to meetings? Can you bill for me? I need a few days to research. Oh, so slow. Get out of the way. I'm the strategist anyway. That's especially the case in PR agencies. Maybe I should just name some of these kinds of agencies, and that's not to diss PR agencies. It's just to say that some of the behavior that comes from that is worth dissing. Okay, so bringing in strategists for the first time is like adopting a child, and a child in the ashes. So leaders, if you're gonna bring it in, you gotta raise that child. All right, just wanted to try a little bit of a different format. I've got so much stuff coming up this year. You know, I think about the creative bets that I want to place, the things I've been learning. I want to place bigger creative bets. Just trying to get some of this business stuff that we're doing with Sweathead and the team into a better place. And then I'm like, okay, what's the next bet? Let me know if you enjoyed this. Please forward it to a friend. You can review or rate the podcast. We've had like 1.4 million views. Strategists, come on. You're a little quiet, you know? I think we've got like 80 reviews or something. I don't ask for it all the time, but 5 years, 1.4 million listens. I said views, listens. 80 reviews. Jeepers. If this was like a yoga podcast, there's tons of reviews. But make it nice. Make it nice. I am sensitive despite my sarcasm. Well, I guess that's why I'm sarcastic, isn't it? Isn't it? Lots of good stuff coming up. Go to sweathead.com to find out more. Follow us on Instagram at sweathead. I'm at Mark Pollard. Thank you for listening. You're part of that journey that I've been talking about, me trying to kind of self-actualize, and I wish it on you as well. See you next time. Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.